The Internet Multicasting Service presents the National Press Club Luncheon with speaker Mickey Cantor.
Our guest today is a truly unique individual. He is one member of the original Clinton cabinet who still holds his job. He is not under investigation for any wrongdoing, as far as we know. Most important, he is successful in achieving his agency's objectives. Ambassador Mickey Cantor is a genuine hero of the Clinton administration. As United States Trade Representative, he has led negotiations to extend the North American Free Trade Agreement to Mexico, including side agreements to protect labor and the environment. He's negotiated to reform the world's trading rules and create the new World Trade Organization. He's led negotiations to convene the first meeting between the U.S. President and leaders of the Asian Pacific Economic Coordination Council. He's opened markets for U.S. products and services in Japan and elsewhere. And he's convinced China to enforce its laws against piracy of patents, trademarks, and copyrights. Who would have thought Mickey Cantor would run up such a remarkable record? After all, he admits he didn't know anything about trade when he was sworn in as USTR in the first days of the Clinton administration. He was just another lawyer who enjoyed the game of politics, democratic politics, almost as he does baseball. Some of you may remember that sport. Unfortunately for Mr. Cantor, his batting average in politics was worse than Michael Jordan's in baseball. Mr. Cantor played in the losing campaigns of, get this now, George McGovern in 1972, Jerry Brown in 1976, Jimmy Carter's re-election bid in 1980, and Walter Mondale's campaign in 1984. It wasn't until he joined a team of a relatively unknown and rather loquacious governor from Arkansas that Mr. Cantor finally found a winner. He headed the Clinton-Gore campaign in 1992. Ambassador Cantor has a long history of public service. He was the director of the Government's Legal Services Corporation during the Carter years. He served as a consultant to the American Bar Association's Special Committee on Crime Prevention and Control. He's been a member of the Special White House Conference on Children. Back in California, he served on the Christopher Commission, formed after the beating of Rodney King in Los Angeles. He also founded a conservation corps for inner-city youth. In his spare time, Mr. Cantor did some lawyering for the firm of Manatt, Phelps, and Phillips. Though he made his career in Los Angeles, Mr. Cantor actually is a native of Nashville, Tennessee. He's also a graduate of Vanderbilt University and the Georgetown University Law Center. When President John F. Kennedy created the Trade Representative's Office in 1962, he said the person who holds that job would be, quote, one of the top policy officials in the United States government. If that wasn't entirely true then, it certainly is true today. Ladies and gentlemen, one of President Clinton's most trusted advisors, Ambassador Mickey Cantor.
Thank you, Bob, very much. Very nice. When you first started, I thought I never wanted you to quit. But as you proceeded, I couldn't wait for the end. I appreciate all your kind remarks, and I know you were jesting about the others, I think. I am a great example of failing upward in life, to which I owe that advice to Bernard Rappaport, my old friend is here today, which I appreciate very much. He said, always, if you fail, fail upward, don't go down, much better. I want to thank Mark Johnson very much for your kindnesses and having me here for the second time, and I've always enjoyed it, and I look forward, if it's not too bad this time, I'll come back again, I hope. Doug Harbrick, thank you for organizing this. Obviously, when someone like Doug invites you to do this and he's covering you, there's only one answer you give, a very quick yes. I assume I've bought some goodwill out of this, at least I hope so. I also want to note, not only here at the head table, but in the room are some very important people to me and their colleagues who have been more responsible for what has happened in trade other than the President of the United States over the last 26 months. And I think it should not go unrecognized here in Washington that many of us who've been given these exalted positions as bureaucratic thugs get to stand before you and take all the accolades for what has been done that is good. Sometimes we get criticism for what has not been done. But the fact is we have people working with us who make this happen. And I have been blessed as a trade representative to have, I believe, the best people in Washington. And the president is blessed to have them, and they are blessed to have a president who understands how our economy, domestic and foreign, fits together and how trade is such a vital part. So I'd like to recognize Ambassador Charlene Barshefsky, who's my chief deputy. I rescued Charlene from one of these Washington law firms. We in Los Angeles don't hold them in that higher repute. Ann Lozado, who's headed public affairs, has done a marvelous job. She's managed, in fact, to have people even like me sometimes. Ann, nice to have you here. Somewhere, and I can't see with all these bright lights, Peter Scheer, my chief of staff, is here. Peter, I don't know where you are. You're over here. Peter Scheer, my chief of staff, is over here. Also here, and I'll go through quickly, are people I rely on so much, and I'll come back to Lee Sands and Deborah Lair and Kathy Field, talk about Tom Robertson as well, but David Marchik and Jeff Nechterlein are here as well. I hope I didn't miss too many people in that, but I am delighted all of you are here because you deserve whatever plaudits we all get, starting with the president, for these 70, now 74 trade agreements in now 26 months. It's never been equaled in American history, and this starts with the President of the United States. Our trade policy, its principles, its opportunities, its responsibilities, what we have found, were really defined by President Clinton, both as he announced on October 3rd, 1991, his speeches at Georgetown, and later that fall, speech to the New York Foreign Affairs Council in April of 1992, and then in Los Angeles, the World Affairs Council in May, his October 4, 1992 speech to North Carolina State University in Raleigh, where he supported the NAFTA, one of the more courageous acts a presidential candidate has ever done. He supported it with the caveat of the side agreements. Remember, if we win Ohio and Michigan, let's go back to those days, this race is over. NAFTA, of course, is a very emotional subject in those states. It would have been easy for this president to say no to NAFTA, but and try to renegotiate with our Mexican allies after he went into office. This president stood up to that test as he did later in 1993 when he took on leaders even in his own party to ensure the fact that NAFTA would pass the Congress. This is a president who understands that jobs and our standard of living depend on how we're going to interact with the global economy over the next number of decades. That growth, both global growth and growth in our own economy, which is so critical to us, is critical as far as trade is concerned, and that global stability, foreign policy, trade has become a vital part of that, and I want to talk about that a little later. That the larger strategy the president has implemented, everything from getting our own economy in order, and ensuring that it's connected to a larger policy with trade and international economics is working and working well. That this first president, the first president born after the Second World War, the first president to come into office after the Cold War has ended, understood both the challenges and the opportunities that we faced. He understood that we must compete and win in a new world economy. Literally, he looked at 3 points in a trade policy which we've tried to implement. Trade is increasingly important to our economy here at home. Let me just go to this chart and I'll come back. I hope you can hear me, but at least I'll point from here. I hope most of you can see this. I'm using this because I think that, number one, Ross Pro was very successful in doing it. And I hope someday I'd have the kind of money that Ross has. So I'm going to do it. But number two, I think it does illustrate what it said. From 1970 to 1994, trade, which was barely 13% of our economy in 1970, if you can see right here, by 1994 is almost 28% of our economy. It's become a critical mass. It's $1.8 trillion. 11 million people are employed in our export markets in trade. Let me show you this. As you look at U.S. jobs supported by exports, and by the way, these jobs pay on the average about 17% higher than regular jobs in our economy. They've grown from, in 1986, barely over 6.5 million to over 11 million jobs in 1994. Now, that's explosive growth. That's not just impressive, it's explosive. And if you indexed on a scale of 100, you would see amazing growth in jobs, about at 400 on the index to regular growth in jobs in our economy, about 184 export jobs to regular jobs. So what we have is, for every $1 billion in exports, 17,000 new jobs, they pay more, trade is growing faster than our economy, jobs in exports are growing faster than jobs in the rest of our economy. So obviously, this has become critical to our future. Our companies are globalized. Our companies are interdependent. Our countries are interdependent. This is a central element of our future, and you can't run away from it, and this president hasn't. And I'd also like to say a bipartisan group in the Congress, the majority, has supported this policy. We've kept trade bipartisan, as it should, as did the Reagan and Bush administrations, and we intend to do that in the future. Second, trade is central to our foreign policy. It used to be, of course, during the Cold War, that political and strategic issues ruled the day for good reason. Trade took a back seat. International economics were a tool, frankly, of the Cold War in order to bolster political and strategic concerns. Now, of course, what we see is that trade has become an issue in and of itself. It's the way, it's the connecting tissue between countries in a post-Cold War world. Having trade as a tool to advance our political and economic interests in a Cold War world was the right policy, and it worked. As we built up the economies of Japan and Europe, they became bulwarks against Soviet expansionism. As that occurred, of course, it strengthened the U.S. position in the world. But those days are over. And now, full engagement, not containment, have become the words of the day. Remember, mutual assured destruction? Now we're at mutual assured prosperity. So, as economic power spreads around the earth, it frankly, just a few years ago, we were 40% of the world's output in this country. We're now 20%. And frankly, that's going to become less over the next number of years, no matter how fast we grow. That is important, and it's good. Global growth is in our interest. Why? Because as we have global growth, you develop a middle class and industrialization and stability. What is more important for a mature economy and the most powerful nation on earth than stability and growth? That is in our interest, and that is important to where we're going with our trade policy. And last but not least, the third point is economic strength begins at home. Frankly, as we have become more productive and competitive as a people, the president recognized quite clearly in his speeches that if we didn't put our house in order here, lower the budget deficit, reinvent government, do something about education, as Dick Riley has done so well with Goals 2000 and School to Work, as we've done with, I think, the signature program of this administration, National Service. If we didn't train our people and educate them and make them more productive and competitive, create more opportunity as well as demand responsibility, we couldn't compete and win in a global economy. So what's happened? 6 million new jobs in this economy in just 24 months, and it keeps going up. We've dropped the unemployment rate to 5.4%. Working together in a bipartisan effort to make the country strong again so we can compete and win. Remember that number again. 4% of all the consumers in the world live within our borders. 96% live outside our borders. If you become productive and competitive and each worker is producing more per worker, and you're at zero population growth, and you are growing economically more slower than the so-called emerging markets or developing countries, and your labor force is growing more slowly, all of you as business people who are the business people in the room understand you've got a slight problem. If your market's not growing and you're more productive, you've got to go find new markets. So all this fits together. We want a healthy and growing global economy with increasing middle class because they are our consumers of the future as we make sure we remain competitive and productive. That's where this administration has been going. That's why this president has been so successful. And I believe we're building a real consensus around the world. We could have never finished the Uruguay round without that kind of consensus. Now we are faced with where do we go in the next 6 years? What are we going to do in this administration to ensure that what we have done becomes reality? Trade agreements, I've learned, in many cases are pieces of paper, some of which have gathered dust, unfortunately, over the years. We intend to do what we call, I hope someone gets the joke, laughingly, the three E's in our office. We're going to implement, enforce, and expand. Thank you very much. It's the only joke I've ever made up in my life. And I'm just delighted you laughed at that. Let me start with implementation. The World Trade Organization, of course, just an hour and a half or maybe 2 hours ago now, confirmed Renato Ruggiero as the first Director General. It was important to come to a consensus around a person. What was done during that process, I think, was helpful, not harmful. Many saw it as an impasse. It was at some point. But the ability of all of us to take leadership and to understand the importance of coming together and to reach an agreement that we can all live with, that is going to advance the organization in the future, makes us stronger and healthier and better able to meet the challenges of the future. We need to have discipline and consensus and commitments. But the most important thing about the World Trade Organization and the Uruguay Round, it is a single undertaking. I'm going to come back to that, but let me talk about what that means. For years, we have suffered in trade in this world because we had an MFN system which allowed free riders. The GATT system, developed in 1947, which is now going out of existence in the next few months, had six different agreements which were the underlying agreements of the GATT, the General Agreements on Tariff and Trade. No more than 45 nor less than 27 countries ever signed on to those agreements. The rest of the countries who were members of GATT were free riders. Now what does that mean? As economic power, it was fine when we were the preeminent economic power in the world. We could absorb everyone's imports, not affect jobs in our country, be able to continue to expand economically, and not be hurt. But as economic power spreads around the globe, it is critical that we all play by the same rules. Reciprocity, comparability become the words of the day, not free riders. And what we've agreed to in the Uruguay round is, in a single undertaking, that after 5 years in most cases for developing countries, 10 years in just a very few cases, everyone will play by the same rules. I can't tell you, I can't overemphasize how critical that is. Now, if you play by the same rules, if we educate our people, if we have a strong economy at home, if we're productive and competitive, we will compete and win in this world economy. We got more to do with the WTO as well. It is an amazing agreement in the sense of Uruguay round. It cuts tariffs by 40%, cuts non-tariff barriers, covers intellectual property rights and services for the first time, has an enormous impact on agriculture, as many of you know. We now are negotiating agreements on financial services and basic telecom. It is a challenge. It's a challenge not only for the United States and the European Union and Japan, but for all of our trading partners, and we'll be a willing participant in those negotiations. North American Free Trade Agreement has gone, it been in effect for 1 year. In the first year, of course, it was a more than a rousing success. It was an astonishing success. We grew our trade to Mexico by 22%, to Canada, our largest trading partner and the largest trading relationship in the world, by 12%. We increased jobs by 133,000 net jobs in this country simply because of the North American Free Trade Agreement. Obviously, some of those numbers will be altered to some degree because of what's happened in Mexico over the last, since December 20, I guess it's now 3 months. The fact is that NAFTA is critical and important. We built the largest free trade area in the world. Two administrations supported it. A bipartisan majority supported of Congress supported it. It's going to go forward. It will be successful, and we'll move forward with Chileans accession as well. There are many things we have to address in the NAFTA, everything from concerns about labeling, border technicalities, tariff accelerations, small package delivery. These problems will come up. But let me tell you one of the tenets of trade I've learned, by the way, in this fast education that I've had, Bud. What I've learned is, are you taking notes?
Yes.
The larger your trade relationship with the country, the more problems you have. That seems to make good sense. Most people don't understand that. We have $1 billion a day in Canadian dollars every day in trade with Canada. Think of that. Almost $1 billion in U.S. dollars a day. About $260 billion a year between the U.S. and Canada every year. Largest in the world. If only 3% is out of whack, That's $7 or $8 billion. Now, to the people involved in those industries, it's a lot of money, and it's difficult. But 97% is going very well. And so what I would tell you is, when you see a large trading relationship, watch out, because you're going to see countries beginning to get into certain, annoyances with each other, which are going to result in negotiations. And the question is, can we manage them and manage them effectively? I think we're doing that with Canada. We have a wheat commission. We have a softwood lumber commission. We solved beer one and beer two. We're going to be able to address, I think, the so-called cultural issues successfully. And I'm deeply grateful for our Canadian counterparts for all of that progress. Second is enforcement, and enforcement is critical, not only of these agreements, but of our trade laws themselves. That's the only way we're going to build credibility with American people. Let me talk about that just for a second. When we came into office, never in the history of Gallup polling had the American people believed that trade was more in their interest than to their detriment. For the first time in November 1994, the Gallup poll shows now a majority of the American people believe trade is in their interest, not to their detriment. That's credit to the president. Credit to a bipartisan majority in the Congress. And we've got to make sure that continues. Nothing is more important to ensuring that than saying, we'll stand up for the American people where we're right. We'll stand up for their interests. We'll stand up for their legitimate laws. We'll stand up to make sure these trade agreements work. We will not be moved when we believe there's something wrong going on and it's adversely affecting their interests. That is not only in the best interest of the American people, it's in the best interest of a world trading system. We have got to get rid of these barriers to trade, both tariff and non-tariff, at the border and interior, which have an adverse effect upon trading relationships and upon our economy. Let me talk about China and Japan very quickly. I'd like to note again Charlene Barshefsky, Lee Sands, Deborah Lair, Kathy Field, Tom Robertson. They did a marvelous job in China with regard to intellectual property rights. Remember what this represents, our fastest growing industries, high wage, high skill jobs, the industries of the future. We were getting slaughtered, literally slaughtered. Last year, 29 plants produced 75 million compact and laser discs. 70 million were exported as far away from China as Canada and even the United States. Inside China alone was costing us $800 million to $1 billion a year. We didn't even calculate what it was costing us in third country markets. It might have been double. We had to do something about that. We sat down after months of negotiation, and the people I just mentioned did a marvelous job, and so did their Chinese counterparts. And we came up with a tough, no-nonsense enforcement agreement that will work. And both sides are committed to it. And I would like to say it has other aspects to it as well. One is, it alters the court system in China to some degree to allow more access. And those who are concerned about human rights who thought the president's courageous decision on MFN might have been wrong, just think about starting to alter a court system to provide more access and the rule of law and more respect for law. And that's what this agreement does. So the president's policy of going on parallel tracks of pursuing human rights on one track and trade agreements or trade on the other is working and working well due to the very hard work of these folks. We also reached an 8-point agreement with China. Most of you know about to re-engage talks in Geneva. China's desire to join the World Trade Organization. We also reached an agreement on agriculture, reached an agreement on space launch. It was quite a 2.5 days I spent there, but the reason I could do that on behalf of the president is because of the hard work of these folks. I think they deserve a round of applause, frankly. The other is Japan. I know none of you have been waiting for that. We've had, since we've been in office, 14 different agreements with Japan. Many of them are critical. All of them are beginning to work. In the last 4 months, I'd like to report that our trade deficit with Japan has come down each month for the last 4 months. Some of that has to do with exchange rates. Some has to do with these agreements. A lot has to do with the countries beginning to understand we have got to address this trade deficit. The trade deficit with Japan is not a product. Let me say it again. Not a product of one country or the other being more competitive or productive. It's a matter of barriers, traditional barriers in Japan, which have been set up to keep out foreign competitive goods. It's changing. Frankly, Japanese observers, writers, professors, politicians have all written they have to open up their economy, if not only for the good of the world economy, not only for the United States or our trading partners, but if they're going to be competitive and innovative and raise their own standard of living, in, because that's the way you lower prices. It should not escape anyone's attention that Japanese workers are the second highest paid workers in the world, but their standard of living, of course, is not as high as many developed countries. And the reason is because prices are so high because there's so little competition in these markets. So our desire is to work with the Japanese government to open these markets in every way possible. From cellular telephones to government procurement and construction to telecommunications to medical equipment to glass to insurance to apples to rice. We've had 14 agreements. These agreements are beginning to work. We need to be patient. But we are going to make sure these markets are open because it's in everyone's interest. And we're going to make sure they fully engage as soon as possible with talks with Japan on auto and auto parts. Let me mention that just for 1 second. 60% of our trade deficit with Japan is auto and auto parts, $36 billion, and I'll be glad to elaborate on that a little later. It's 22% of our overall trade deficit with the world. It has a huge impact on the U.S. economy. As you know, our automobile industry does, an inability to get cars and parts into Japan has that impact as well. We have been invited back and we have accepted. On Monday, we will be in Japan, a joint USTR commerce team to re-engage these discussions. We have high hopes for these discussions, and I hope our Japanese counterparts do as well. We must address this issue in an effective way, and I trust that we will. Other expansion areas, of course, include the APEC, the Asian Pacific Economic Cooperation Forum mentioned earlier. The president, of course, had all the leaders in Seattle in 1993 in November. Between the time we did NAFTA and the time we finished a year of a round, we squeezed in all the leaders of APEC except one showed up, re-engaged APEC, which had up to then been a consultation and discussion organization, into something real, which will begin to grow trade in this Asian area, the fastest growing area of the world. Then at Bogar, led by President Suharto and President Clinton, we agreed with our trading partners in APEC to open up APEC to free trade by the year 2010 or 2020, depending on the status of your country being developed or developing. The free trade area of the Americas, developed at the Summit of the Americas in the Miami process that the president organized with every country in the region but one, every democracy in the region, all of them market economies, only one non-democracy left, second fastest growing region of the world, a tremendously growing middle class. We agreed to open up that area to free trade by the year 2005, and we'll have our first trade ministers ministerial meeting after our officials meeting on June 30th in Denver, Colorado. We have other things to move forward with the European Union, with Eastern European countries, and of course Chile's accession to the NAFTA. Let me give you the status of that. We've had meetings of our NAFTA partners. We're developing criteria. We'll have meetings in April with Chile and their officials. In May, we'll have a ministers' meeting, and that's moving ahead very quickly. Let me add just a few more areas of expansion. We've had enforcement. We've talked also about implementation. Let me add a few more areas of expansion. One thing that stunned me when I came into this office, which should stun all of you as journalists, is these international institutions are closed. They're closed to you. They're closed to the public. Documents aren't available. There's no right of participation. As a lawyer, especially in practicing in California and formerly a legal services lawyer representing poor people, I was stunned by this. Didn't understand, thought it hurt our credibility, believed it didn't help these organizations at all. Now we're starting to open up these organizations. In NAFTA, we have a much more open organization than under the Canadian Free Trade Agreement. The World Trade Organization is going to open even more and allow documents to be not only allowed to be made public, but also, we hope, to allow others not only to file documents, but ultimately to participate in the proceedings as people should, non-governmental organizations. We're making decisions that affect the lives and the welfare of a number of people, and they ought to have a right to participate. Second, we've got to address issues heretofore seen internal to countries that don't seem like the trade issues that didn't in the past. Remember 10 years ago, if I had said service, intellectual property rights, or other matters, they wouldn't have been trade issues as well. So let me mention those before I go on too long. Anti-competitive practice or enforcing your antitrust laws, transparency, corruption and bribery. There's no more important subject for us to take up than corruption and bribery in trade. It is a non-tariff barrier that is having an adverse effect upon trade around the world. We're the only country in the world with a Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. We'd like to see that extended to other countries as well. The OECD is doing good work in this area. We support it, and we hope in our meetings in Paris we can advance that agenda. There's also labor and the environment. We have only been trying since the Treaty of Versailles in 1919, which talked about the intersection of trade and labor standards, to have some rational discussion in a multilateral organization about labor and trade, just to have a discussion. From 1947, the Havana Charter, which was turned down, as you know, did intersect labor and trade, as all of you know. And then by 1994 at Marrakesh, we finally got a commitment in the Marrakesh Declaration that WTO would take up that discussion. Renato Ruggiero has pledged himself to be faithful to all the Marrakesh Declaration, so we look forward to that discussion. It only took 47 years since the Havana Charter. Things move somewhat slowly in trade, but we're getting there. The environment, we have a Trade Environment Committee of the World Trade Organization. It's going to begin its work. It's long overdue, and it's something that we all can look forward to. What we're trying to do is secure the American dream. This is in our interest. As the President said, we've got to compete, not retreat. We've got to raise our standard of living in an ever more competitive world. We've got to make sure we improve the lives of the American people. The President's doing it every day. Middle class Bill of Rights, crime, education, welfare reform, reinventing government, keeping the deficit down, maintaining discipline. But we've got to take these opportunities and responsibility in trade as well and continue to move forward. I remember a statement made by Chancellor Kohl, who was the first outsider ever to speak to the French Senate just 1 year ago, in talking about the Uruguay round. He said, "We cannot hide behind our fears." Nothing can be more descriptive of what we're trying to do now with this trade policy. We must reach out and grab this opportunity and take the responsibility. It means peace, it means growth, it means economic security. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Ambassador. The first question is from a member of the audience who kind of takes issue with the introduction. "Mr. Ambassador," he says, "the U.S. trade gap ballooned to a record $12.23 billion in January. The dollar continues to fall to record lows against the Japanese yen and the German mark. Mexico, which was touted by your administration as the very model of an emerging economy, is now in desperate crisis. On what grounds can Mr. Carman say that the Clinton administration's trade policies have been successful?" I don't want to answer that. You answer that now.
You're welcome to answer it if you wish. First, let's take the trade deficit, which I think is vastly overstated. Sometimes, when it gets better or gets worse, we jump on it when it gets better and tell you how wonderful things are. When it gets worse, the rest of you in the room jump on us and say, "You're not doing your job." Let me make, first of all, our trade deficit, although in dollar volume the largest in history last year, 1994, was only the sixth largest trade deficit since 1959 in terms of gross domestic product. The trade deficit, in fact, is a much smaller part of our gross product than it has been in five other years. So that's number one. Number two, let's look at January. I look back the last 6 years, and I didn't have time to go further. Every January but one for the last 6 years, our trade deficit gets worse. Now, I don't know why. I'd like to give you an answer for that. Last year, our trade deficit from December to January, 93-94, was 73% worse. This year, it's only 56% worse. Is the glass half full or the glass half empty? I mentioned Japan. Now for four straight months, their deficit has come down. It's not surprising under the current circumstances that, of course, now we have a trade deficit with Mexico, not a trade surplus. That is one of the worst-kept secrets, or least shocking things. Reminds me of Casablanca. What is it? Rick says, "I'm shocked about gambling," or something like that. The fact is that we expected that. The major reason is, and it's good news, folks, our economy is so much stronger than our major trading partners, we continue to draw in goods. That's to be expected. That always happens when you have a strong economy. 6 million new jobs, more productive and competitive, record profits in almost every industry in America. Our income is going up. Bankruptcies are down. There's something to celebrate here. Sure, that means you have more and more imports, but our exports are the largest in American history, and trade increased more in dollar volume in 1994 than any time in American history. So as you look at these numbers, look behind them. What we're exporting is, represents high value added goods, represent high wage, high skill jobs. Now, NAFTA has nothing to do with what happened in Mexico with the peso. There's not one expert, not an economist you can find that will say that outside of Pat Buchanan. That's my second joke, Bernie. There is no connection between the two. NAFTA is working. And let me make one other point. And I'm sorry to go on so long, but this, I think it makes a difference. Without NAFTA, can you imagine what would have happened with the peso doing what it did, in other words, devaluing on December 20th? Without the confidence NAFTA created, we'd have a much worse situation than we have today. Mexico's going to come back. There's underlying strength in that economy. The middle class in Mexico doubled in the last 8 years in terms of their workforce. That's an amazing statistic. So we have done well. This president has been the most successful president in American history in trade. The NAFTA is important, it's critical, and it's successful. The Uruguay Round, finishing that, which three administrations worked on, let's not get too puffed up here, is an important agreement and will make a huge difference. Remember, it hasn't kicked